Okay, over then to, well, you've got the correspondence from the minister and the department yesterday about the, I've asked for Frank Dickens to be here because there's some implications, the Money Bills Act. Unfortunately, I think he's in the Appropriations Committee, so he's going to come. All right, so basically, Mo, over to you.
Thank you, Jeff. And members and apologies for walking in the debate. Yeah, it's not today we have to open the taxation of the land and vote and
So we're here today for the tax laws amendment bill and the tax administration laws administration bill. I think since we had the last discussion where we presented the response document, that was 2 weeks ago, I think, we presented the response document and there were one or two issues that we said would be outstanding. The big issue that we raised that would be outstanding was just the implementation or the timing of the retirement reforms related to annuitization of provident funds. And I'll deal with that in a moment. I just want to deal with the easier matter, which at that meeting, although the Banking Council Association was there, we were asked to check with them. I think they are now happy with, there's been some contact with them, and they are happy with the approach that they used in the book. But we got the insurance industry really contacting us quite urgently because some of the provisions related to SAM, solvency assessment, I don't know what it's the management, right? Which is basically the kind of Basel III version for the insurance industry. Now that is related to, or will be implemented in terms of a new bill which has been published for comment, the insurance bill, and hopefully will be tabled in Parliament before it rises this year. But I think some of our regulators are very enthusiastic about its passage and thought that it would be passed by Parliament already, and therefore SAM would be in place from 1st January 2016. Obviously that is not the case, and in fact the Twin Peaks legislation does need to go through first because that legislation is dependent on the Twin Peaks legislation. So I'm sure we'll all agree that it would be very risky to think that legislation will be passed before the second half of next year. And therefore, I think what we're saying is let's be more realistic. SAM will really only take effect at the earliest on the 1st of January 2017, and that's the day that we're targeting. And therefore, some of the provisions that we had related to valuation and so on do not have to go through now. So what the letter does is we want to motivate that two clauses be, or clause be pulled from this, from the bill at table by the Minister of Finance. So we will have to kick in the money bills procedure, procedure to amend money bills legislation that we have. And I hope Advocate Jenkins is here to advise us. Chair. So certainly what the letter deals with is that there are some changes to the insurance related issues because of SAM, and there are one or two technical issues that they raise, so we are going to correct that. We'll give you the detail as we talk through it. We do have someone from the FSB, Andre Urte. So Andre is here at the back. Olano is here and Yanga to lead on the change there. So those are two substantive issues that we are going to ask be amended from the version of the bill as table. So the insurance runs here. When we spoke to you the last time, we thought that the issues in fact had been sorted out, but immediately we had people literally breaking our door down. So we just want to bring that to your attention when we go clause by clause, that that's what's motivating the change on the insurance provision. Okay, if you like, I can go into the retirement issues you want me to start.
Oh, let's go to this issue. That's okay. I'll let women want to take hold and then come back. Why don't we just do this one at a time? Because we've had discussions about this before. So I would suggest we do this one now. On the solvency matter, what is the view of members? Or what are the views of members? Anybody got an issue with that? No. Fine, so we're agreeing with that.
Yeah, I should add that obviously we'll bring it back next year, so it's just been without, and then it will still be in time for them.
Yeah, how?
Assume what we don't have an objection, there is a question of process which we will deal with when bank gets here.
Well,
yeah.
Well, let me come to the point that that's also the role of the
department. Yeah, thank you.
Right. Next thing?
Yeah. The retirement provisions. Let me just, I don't know if members have the media statement that we put out on the day that the Minister of Finance tabled the bill, which was last week, Tuesday, by the court. Chair, now, at the end of the last time, let me just give a brief history to this. And the Minister alluded to this matter in the NDBCS speech that he delivered on a very quiet day in Parliament. And also, last week when he tabled the tax laws at Edinburgh, he said that this was an issue we're going to have a short and sharp consultation on. So we produced a media statement just to write it up. So say what we did was, and just to take us back, in 2013, so before the term of this committee, the previous standing committee on finance approved a number of retirement reforms. Some of them were tax related, some not. So for example, in the Pensions Fund Act, there were amendments made to, for example, criminalize when employers don't hand over the contribution of members to the pension fund. We enjoyed great support from the unions. We had, I don't know, 30, 40 meetings with the unions for those provisions. And part of the package was that we also noticed that provident fund members don't get a tax deduction when they make a contribution to a provident fund from their own salary. The employer component is a non-taxable tax benefit which they get. And we had thought at the time it's mainly low-income workers. But subsequently, when the law came out, we realized the other objective was that we saw that many people at a high income level, obviously other people who save, but tended to get more than, say, 22% or 22.5% of their remuneration. And we also found that remuneration, the way it was defined for a retirement annuity, for your pension fund, your provident fund, all varied. So we put this reform in place. There was a paper out, we explained it, and we then limited, we said we shouldn't discriminate between retirement funds. We should just say all retirement funds, your contribution up to 27.5% on a remuneration base that should be common across all three is allowed, and up to a maximum of 350,000. That is just to limit the deduction to higher income taxpayers. Because obviously they would be the people who save more and they reduce their tax liability by saving more. So that was sort of put in 2013. The condition we put, of course, is that if you want to enjoy the tax deduction, you must annuitize. And don't deal with it in the law now. In future, just so that nobody can accuse us of doing this through the back door, we want to say that we will say, and you will also preserve, okay? We're not talking 100% preservation, just like when we say you shall annuitize. We say you shall annuitize 2/3 of your retirement savings at the point of retirement or exit, and 1/3 would be a lump sum, which is in line with what is the pension law currently. Okay. Chris, we'll go into the detail. So this was passed in 2013. And what happened last year, members will recall that we had discussions in that trade union federation in particular had big reservations on proceeding with the annuitization bit. They didn't mind that we give them the tax deduction. They said, you need to link the two. But they had asked that this matter be of annuitization of provident funds be delayed by 2 years. When we brought it to Parliament, I think members saw that the benefit is such that by delaying it for 2 years, we were actually denying the tax deduction to probably rethink at least 1.5 to 2 million, if not more, members of provident funds. And most of them would be at the low to low middle income level. Okay. Obviously, they had to be above the tax threshold. Some would be below the tax threshold and therefore couldn't get the tax deduction, wouldn't make much of a difference to them. So in delaying it, and let me say here, after we delay it, a lot of people were very angry with us. Some of them are sitting behind me, okay, about why did we delay this? We didn't give much notice. It was done at the last minute. And that's why we had to use the procedure to amend clauses as well. If I recall, I had to phone the minister at the time, and you had to get a letter from the minister to delay that provision by a year. The committee had asked us to come back and report on consultations with NEDLAC before you pass the bill this year. So that's why we brought it in. You notice it wasn't in the July version as a clause, but what it was in the press statement, we just reminded one and all that this was an issue that would certainly be put into the final version of the bill, and that we would possibly be changing the threshold, what we call the de minimis, the amount that your annuity needs to reach before you are forced to annuitize. So now, let me just say that we've not made much progress, I'm afraid to say, within NEDLAC, that though there is support for it, but certainly, for example, one of the trade union federations, COSATU, does feel that unless and until government releases the social security reform paper, they will not engage on this matter. So that's why I don't think you've got a submission from them. And they just said that they will be opposed to any changes because they see these as piecemeal. Certainly, I think the minister is quite concerned and he's called our meetings that we have a constructive engagement, we act in the interest of members of provident funds. And, you know, bear in mind that most of your provident fund members are probably members of are workers in the private sector and in perhaps some municipalities. At national and provincial government, I'm not sure there's any provident fund, certainly not in CEPF and so on. So depending on the composition of membership, you might find that, you know, some have actually, it may not be the biggest union, but they may actually have more members of provident funds. So the other federations have come back. And one federation has said they want us to continue as we planned last year. And one has said that they would prefer a slight delay, but they can look with option one, still awaiting their submission. So we did this 1 week consultation after last week, Tuesday. Chris and Olano can just go through this and we'll just work through the issues in more detail so you see what the options were that we put on the table. Do you want to kick off? Okay, so we don't need to flash these, but you have these.
Thanks, Malik. Honourable Minister, just to go through the process of what we did. We came on the 15th, we presented the response document. We said in the response document there were two options for what we could do to try and incorporate the concerns on immunization. So we put the options in the response document. We said we can either continue and have a much higher threshold at which people were to immunize, or we can delay the immunization. But because we have a principle that if you immunize, you get the full deduction, but if you don't immunize, you don't get the full deduction, that would imply that Provident Fund members would then have a lower tax deduction than other retirement funds. And those are the two options we put forward in the response document for slide 2. Slide 3 is just to show that the Minister has been trying to put his support behind the amendments to say, look, we do need to provide an environment where individuals can convert their savings into income in retirement. There are a lot of other issues that relate to this in terms of getting appropriate price. But also that it is a good thing to do, and it's, you know, what one of the aims of these reforms are. In the fourth slide, this is just to show what the options were. So in the media statement that Mona mentioned on the 27th of October when the TLAB was tabled in Parliament, that table sums up what the different options were. So the first one is to go through with the reforms, but with a higher debt limit. Second one was to delay the reform. Third one was to delay it even longer, but then have a lower tax deduction. And the third one was just to allow Provident Funds to be separated from retirement community funds and pension funds just going forward, and would have the lower tax deduction. So we asked industry and we asked all the stakeholders for a quick consultation for that week on these options. And what they say, what are the issues, what are the problems, could we be trying to find something where we can accommodate concerns. On slide 5, it just shows the submissions received. So we received 23 separate submissions. 19 of those submissions, most of them from industry associations, administrators and consultancies, and the One Labour Federation, as Mona mentioned, the NEDLAC, supported option 1. To go through with the current proposal that they are, but have a higher day limit or immunization threshold so that fewer Provident Fund members would be affected, and in effect it would mean a longer phase in for those Provident Fund members. Of the 4 submissions that didn't support option 1, 1 supported option 2, while the other 3 felt we can't support any of these options until social security reform is either the paper is released or there is movement on social security reform. But didn't support any of the options, those 3. The 3rd Labour Federation at NEDLAC really supported the version of option 2 and said that they're comfortable with option 1 to be implemented from 1 March 2016. So those are the submissions received in terms of what we could do going forward. Just to give some slight detail on what their concerns are with option 2 of delaying the immunisation. A lot of the people thought that this just didn't achieve the retirement reform objectives. If they had a separate dispensation for Provident Funds, there's no harmonization of Provident Funds. It would also not be feasible because we'd have a different tax system for Provident Fund contributions compared to pension funds and retirement pension funds. So it's not harmonizing, it's not as simple, it's difficult to understand. The delay in the immunization itself, it would just be kicking the can down the road. If we delay it by a year, we're going to have these exact same arguments and these exact same meetings the following year where we need to again decide should we go ahead or should we not, and it creates further uncertainty. The proposal that we would limit the tax deduction to 10-15% for Provident Fund members, it would have impacted on the net pay of individuals who would contribute more than that amount. So if an employer contributed 20% to the Provident Fund and we now limited the tax deduction to 15, it would impact their net pay, which obviously could cause labour relations issues. Also, high-income Provident Fund members would leave the Provident Fund. So if they were going to not get a deduction in the Provident Fund, then they would leave and they'd go to the pension fund. But now, if a lot of your lower-income workers remained in the Provident Fund, there'd be no cross-subsidization within the fund. So if there's only lower income members in the fund, there aren't enough contributions coming in to pay the costs of the administration. So it leads to a fragmented system. The funds wouldn't consolidate. There are also concerns that making such a substantial change at this late stage would be very difficult to communicate, and it would increase distrust in government and the retirement fund industry. And just to quickly go through the problems with option 2, and this is really just to give you an idea of you know, if we're looking at these options, which one should we go to, and what are the problems of going for these options? The support for option one, they felt that it didn't meet the objective. The increase in the de minimis was a sufficient condition to allay the concerns of foreign fund members, and that the 2013 amendments have all been already well communicated. They've been there for 2 years, everybody knows what they are, everybody understands what these amendments mean. All the administrators and the payroll guys and employers have already changed all their systems, they've done all the work and spent all the money to line up with what the 2013 amendment should do, and we have already delayed it 5 years. And then the big point is that administrators thought that they would incorporate their pension funds into the provident fund. So then it really would consolidate the retirement funds under option one, because they were all drawn into one because they were the same, and then costs could go down with the energy and the benefit in the longer run. And also provident fund members could have a higher tax deduction. So, I mean, from the reading of the submission, from the discussion with the Labour Federation, the proposal here, because it's not a technical amendment, I believe we have to use down to the note section 11 of the Moneyball Procedures Amendment Act for the TOC to recommend the change. We would propose that the TOC would go for option one, where we do allow the previous amendment to go ahead, but with a much higher statement of annuitization threshold. So it will go up from 75,000 that is currently, or up to 247,500. So if anybody retires from a provident fund with an amount below that, they won't be required to annuitize. And also it would only be for contributions that provident fund members make after 1 March 2016. So it would take quite a long time for those contributions after 1 March 2016 to then grow up. All the amounts they've got in their provident fund at the moment, they can still take without having to purchase an annuity. So we believe this is a good option, and we think there are very good reasons for why we should still support it, because a lot of there is a considerable support for this option from a lot of different spheres and a lot of different stakeholders, including from this committee last year. And we plan to commit that we will work on this social security pay. The minister has said it in an advance stage, and we would like to get it out as soon as we can. And we can consider further options to mitigate the potential negative impact of the state that they've gone into. We do believe a lot of the concern from providence on them is like, well, if we annuitize, suddenly the lien says kicks them out of the state all day gone, and we can't get that. Whereas if you take a lump sum, you can send it on something and still get the all day gone. We recognize that is a very big issue. We did announce that we want to get rid of the lien test. Because of the fiscal constraints, we did. But we can look at further options to try and mitigate this impact. Say, looking at annuities or increasing the need to have a certain level that it's not applicable anymore. So those are the thoughts and our views.
So, I think like Chris has said, in the last page, the last slide just gives you all the comments that we've received. And I think, let me say that in the department, we were sort of veering towards one of the options too. But like Chris has said, when you just heard the problem, like you do something 1 year, then you reverse it the following year, really, And the systems issues, the confusion, that we were then convinced that we just need to bite the bullet. People have prepared. They were very angry with us last year because the systems were prepared. And this year, I think they would actually not believe them. They could even do it next year. So, and I think the key point to know, though, for me when there's any of these issues, is to take the point of treat customers or members fairly. Why should we deny a tax deduction to members of Provident Funds? Okay. Most people will actually, including in the very unions where there may be some opposition, will actually increase their take-home pay every month from the 1st of March next year. Because they get to the, if they, above the tax threshold with the employee contribution, they will actually then enjoy the tax deduction, and it will increase, depending on what they pay, but they will get the tax deduction. Secondly, annuitization is a good objective. We all hear stories of the lack of preservation, and if anything I think you can criticize on is that you should have been much stronger on preservation. We're not at this stage, we're not changing it, so when you resign, you can cash your amount, okay? We want to bring in those kinds of changes next year.
But that's not a tax issue, that is changing the Pensions Fund Act and so on. So that's why I've said we've been very open, that's where we're going to, and we think these are social goods, and that therefore we feel quite strongly that having considered all the provisions, taking the members' interests into account, we believe we should proceed as we intended last year, which is what option one is, and implement this from the 1st of March 2016. I should add here that there, and many funds were ready to change the rules and so on, and there are some funds where the structure, etc., would cause them problems. They're going to just have to change their rules. That's what they have to do in some of these instances. And so the tax measure is really not the issue here. And after having Thomas Piketty here, I think it would be an appropriate time to look at the liberty issues, I think, which we thought of before his talk. But anyway, but translated in English.
Sorry, Chair, Honourable Member, if I could just add to what has been said. I think one area, Chair, where probably self-criticism could be justified for Treasury is how we fell short in terms of how best to communicate these reforms to the wider public. And given that these were supposed to have taken effect from 1 March 2015, I think we acknowledge that we could have tried to come up with an effective communication strategy to see how best we could reach the ordinary workers. It is quite difficult given the number of workers out there and how you try and reach out to each and every single member. So in a way, we tried to piggyback on the unions, given their relative closeness to their members. But obviously, that's supposed to be a bit of a challenge. So I think we have agreed that if indeed these reforms have the blessings of the committee and go through, we will definitely embark on a much concerted communication strategy and using various channels to try and reach out as many members as possible. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you to the team for the presentation. Mr. Chairman, I think that the question of preservation is not an issue at all, and I'm not going to go into that side of things. I'm curious about the now selection of option one. On the 27th of October, the minister did tabled, and then you had issued a great statement calling for submission. So in a very, very short period of time, people reacted, and as you said, they reacted somewhat to robustly. And during those interactions, you seem not to have gone for the option one, despite a great deal of over time of for option two. Yeah, it was kind of the one that you guys were selecting. So why change? And the consultation that took place in the last 5 days, was it really consultation or simply receiving input and then kind of making your decisions about what to recommend to the committee? In other words, were there any real consultations? And if so, what was this constituted on? Now, I noticed the implementation date was delayed, but last year you issued a press statement indicating that if there was no agreement in Midland, there may, not would, there might be a further delay to 2020. And my understanding is industry sort of took that fairly real, and that there is no, as you said, there is no agreement. You're not making any progress yet. And so preparations for implementation in 2016 haven't been embarked on in the same way had people been, there been certainty about when the implementation would be. So what I'd like to know is, during these last 5 days, what kind of input that you receive from particularly from industry about their readiness to implement. I don't think industry, and I can't speak for industry, but certainly we're not opposed to the implementation of option one. Certainly the two options we would have a long debate on. So is industry going to be ready? Are we putting an undue burden on it to get this thing going and the cost of doing it? Remember, Pithis, you mentioned the question about changes a year later. I mean, that to my mind would have been an absurd situation to go through. So I feel that's dealt with. I'm not sure that I fully yet understand option one, being a simple bookkeeper, but what is the impact on the government employee pension? Is it still going to be outside of this? And if so, why, particularly in terms of the capping, why should some people get the benefit of additional tax deductions? I mean, I might be wrong, maybe it is, but let me stop and making, I'm jumping to conclusions now. And then, the question of the capping is, in our view, counterproductive. We're trying to encourage savings. Right now in South Africa, the corporates are the only people who have any savings. Government is bankrupt, we owe so much money. Individuals are bankrupt, they owe too much money. And now we have an opportunity for high income earners to encourage the saving, and we say, no, we don't want you to save. Spend it. You're going to cap the 350, is it? Not 247. I understand 27.5%, but we really don't do the capping. Now, I'm not sure that it's appropriate. Yeah, it is appropriate, in fact. But it seems to me, to us, to fly in the face of the stated policy of encouraging saving, and we don't understand that. Similarly, the question of process, I'm sure we'll deal with in due course. It's going to be an interesting one because I think it'll be the first time that the money clause has been used for this purpose. So I'm quite excited about that. A good tennis match, and I've done a good the first serve is almost an ace. I haven't seen anything returned yet, but Chairman, I'm so pleased the committee deals with things in a lighthearted manner without hitting each other. Thank you for that, and Mona, I do appreciate your sense of humour as well. So, but there are I'm not part of that. But there are serious matters that we deal with, but it's not trade blows. And right now, I don't think you need to trade blows. Thank you.
All right.
Thank you.
You've
been
very much.
Thank you.
I know you're
going to get a discussion. Thank you, sir. I think I want to make a broader comment on the approach. I hear what the department is saying and the proposal that they have put forward with regard to this exercise. But I want the department to also be alive to some of the challenges that ordinary people are confronted with, especially public servants. But as long as there is no clarity and broader engagement on things that are similar to their heart, like you remember when you spoke about the pension reform, there was a serious outcry out there, people saying our pensions are going to be tampered with and so on, and people started to resign. And that is still continuing even now. Now today we are here, and there are submissions, and I hear what you're saying, to say the government was not able to, you relied more on unions, you could not have their outreach programs. And, you know, issues of this nature that involve monies and other things, we really need to go an extra mile as a department. And I think the minister to make sure that there are serious outreach programs. That's 9, one per province, provincial activity where everybody is called and all of you are there, the minister is able to interact with the public. People from all over the place, in a big gathering, once off, and then you are able to clarify certain things. And that word of mouth will also assist and bring confidence to our people. You see, if I look at this thing and the proposals we have made, I don't want to go to options, whether option one or option two or whatever, because even myself, I'm not sure what that is. And your popular view is that as the committee, the popular views around option one and so on and so on. But if you go on what Momo was saying and what you guys are also saying here, there are certain things that you put in inverted commas. What is on advantage? Like the social security. Remember, Momo was saying there are other things that overlap into the other processes. You touched on the syndics, you touched on the social security thing that maybe the employees must extrapolate and then wait for this process and so on. So you are dealing with these things. We know there are areas of overlap, but the ducks must be in a row and move simultaneously if it's possible, so that there is no, that public confidence is always there, because people will say, why rush this and wait on this? Well, you know, this one also has implication on that, and so on. So if you move this key like this, then it becomes easier. So that even in their areas of overlap, they are more complementary, and nobody says there's something here, and we're not going to get surprises in front. But even how you put some of the social security things at an advantage, which also has an implication on some of the things, whatever. There's another one that I saw where you are also saying all those things. So my worry is that all these things are central to national treasure. So you should be knowing what the left hand and right hand are doing and then be able to synchronize. That's what makes me worry. Synchronization of some of the things, and then as and when you engage, then you know, you are even able to tell your public that while this is in progress, but this is how far we are, and so on. You know, those kind of simple things, because, you know, our people are hit by many things, and once you start to touch the little money that this person has, then you are touching something closer to the heart. So as long as you have your ducks in a row and you are able to explain things explicitly, then the better for everybody. So that's the worry that I have here. And that's why I thought it's important for one just to raise it, because even members of parliament on this thing, they confront us in this. But why are you guys pushing on the things and we don't even understand them, and what are the implications? Because in the public eye, this is what some of these things are implying, and you know, those kind of things. So, jailing of some of these things is what must happen around this issue. Thank you, sir.
Who's next?
Adjie?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sorry, I'm in the office with the question.
Can I
say something? Which I've said a million times, and I'll say it a million more times. You'll have to hear it. You see, no member in this committee should ever feel, I don't care how many people from the public are here, starting with me, I've got a master's in sociology, first class for what it's worth, and I'm 51 years in this parliament. I served as a member of the executive. No. I still do not understand some of these issues. Right? So, Brandon, you came last week, if I'm right. Right. The same thing applies to everybody. The responsibility, the onus, is on National Treasury or any government department to explain things simply, clearly, precisely, and concisely. If we don't understand, it's a problem. But our legal election, it's a democracy. Nowhere in the world does the average politician, I've done some work by the way on this,
understand completely tax issues. This is not a truth and reconciliation book. If most of us can speak of 14, 15 hours without notes. That's politics. It's not a universal systems book. It's tax. So no, 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 this is not politics. You know, Pinky, let me tell you. You were being very cautious and so on. You actually, it's exactly my feelings, actually, in some respect, right? I'm not hearing your different views because you're much more technically competent than I am on these issues, right? And so he should be. He's been here for a long time, and he's done all his studies, he's been flying to London to do coursework and all that. So, hey, I'm not going to apologize. I'm very glad you got in here. But, you know, the thing is, I want to please on this thing. I'm interested in a different situation. I don't think we need to vote today. In fact, in any case, I want to speak, but that's not vote. I've also told Mr. Sani, we're not doing anything in the committee with our CDO looking at it carefully. And that means his entire team, involved Sean, whoever he wants to bring. And that's what I want to ask. Don't think we're running and plunging into anything here. Apart from technical issues, as Pinky suggests, they have political implications to what we're doing. Whichever party you come from. So I think people, if we have to sit here till 1 o'clock without taking any decision, so be it. We'll come back and find the time. We'll also seek exemption for the house, as we did yesterday. Because I really think the house, we used to do this before 2009 days, I don't know what's been going on. We used to get exempt. Justice never used to go to Parliament except on rare occasions, so you remember. I think finance was the same. Now, you can't have Court of Foreign Affairs to exempt from the house, that's not a similar committee. I'm not prejudging, I'm not being gentle yet. Yeah? I'm just saying the law is different. These are big issues here. So I don't think we should rush into this thing. Anybody doesn't understand it, I just be mindful. I'm going to tell you, let me start with me. Since I'm the chair, or whatever is in the group here, I don't know what this G-minimus means. I think I know what it means. But hey, who you think in the parliament here understands G-minimus? Right? So you put G-minimus, please, no, I'm tired of it. In brackets, explain the way my mother, who's been to school for 2 days, will understand. So you're laughing. Right. But the more I think about it, I get enraged that he's being in it. Right? I'm not first class in sociology, I don't understand that term. So I'm not stupid, I just don't know this area. And I'm not apologizing. Right? So can we also, let's be clear. I'm agreeing. I'm saying, let us not agree to anything that we don't understand. Yeah. Right. So having said that, now I'll make the decision again probably another 6 months back. I just say we get this in. Even if it's meaningless, it's a Latin word. But fine, over to you.
Thank you, Mr. Charles. I'm
very quick with this myself. Don't worry, so you go ahead.
But to put everyone in perspective.
No problem, you come from a super class, so it's expected.
Well, actually, Mr. Chair, I used to be IAP, so. My first party was ANC, so you must be able to say where I've gone from.
Hear you!
Yes!
What happened? You have a name in England!
You'll be super dumb in the end.
That's not important. The text is important. Can you explain how? And why? What happened?
You have to be sorry. Opposition is required. I mean, on ideology, we all have similar ideologies, but it's the application of ideology which very often is an issue.
Let me tell you something. This treaty is very cordial, okay? The real fact takes place in our country. If you want opposition, come to the ANC. We're a broad front. Sorry, I'm being facetious and teasing on a more serious note now. By the way, can I say something else? That I really feel members are aging towards doing. I'm liking this. You see, in previous committees, what we determined is this is people's parliament. Parliament is increasingly becoming, distant from the people out there. We used to have unions here, we used to have a man that's come from Kaya Leach, this will tell you when he's a system story. He used to sit there, we used to learn to speak all the time. We are elected to govern and to legislate. We will legislate. Ultimately, it's our power to legislate. But up to the last moment that we legislate, okay, I don't see a problem. Within reasonable measure, if people are seated here, if somebody says, what does industry think? You will not national treasury say what industry thinks, right? That's dangerous. But industry may be sitting here. There's no harm in asking one of them to say, what's your view? But ultimately, we will decide. If Kosatu was here, I would say to Kosatu, what's your view?
Right.
We should allow this interaction, really. These are complex issues.
You know? And Zuma Sangha is desperate for your input, right? Because this is really up your street. Money was back in TVO. Oh. Alright, having said all of that, let's now move on. I won't interrupt again. If you believe me, I won't interrupt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, but I think with the ESF president, we don't need any more unreasonableness in Parliament. People will not
I really have to
that's no problem. It's just a matter of time. Mr. Chair, sorry, I'm just being successful. I have a master's in tax and the age to tax and a PA. So I'm so confused when it comes to Indian Lewis retirement law, etc. So, yeah. But my understanding here is that it looks like we're trying to just get away from the difference between a pension and a poverty fund. So there will be no basic difference. And the plus, from my understanding, when you retire from a pension, two-thirds at annuitize. Effectively, in Providence, you didn't have to do any. Okay? And in the past, before this, a contribution to a Providence fund was not a tax deduction for you, but if the company made a contribution, it was tax deductible. So my first question is, I think it's in this document here, page 23. We're talking about page 23. Okay. Line 50. Now, that might be deleted. It says, yeah, a minimum contribution must in a year exceed 3,000. But now we're increasing it to 350,000. Thank you. Well, I'm not sure which one, okay. Show me which version we go to.
I don't know, John. I was going to say to the honourable member, you see, even I'm not a tech expert either, so I share both law and the shared comments. I don't think any question is too stupid to ask. In fact, they probably are the right questions to ask. Especially, that's how people hide behind high charges and so on. But I don't think I'm going to get into the wording, because that's where we leave it to our legal experts to confess.
If you deal with the point,
then they will make sure that the wording is to that effect.
Thanks for co-chairing, but you're right.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, but the lawyer in me now always looks at the wording, because it's easier to understand, all right?
Okay. But serious note, you are pressing the taxpayer thing, right?
Yeah, okay. As I'm saying, my wife, when she heard I'm going to be sitting on the commission, you can't sit in the same room as the commission. But anyway, okay, so that 30,000 will be taxed to the new maximum, which is going to probably, I don't know what it's going to be, 247 or 350. Yeah. And what about the 350 in the pension? That can say 350 for the pension contributions. Yeah. So if we're going to make things the same, why don't we make them the same? What's the difference of 100,000 bucks if we could? So, you know, why make it 247 for a province and 350 for a pension? That would be my feat. We're going towards a long-term criminalization. So that would be my one input on that. And then, obviously I don't like happening, because the pension funds and provident funds are the main investors in the stock exchange and in business one way or the other. And that's what we do need to do. But I think that's the ideology difference we have to fight in the next round. But that's not a matter for amendment at this stage. Okay, then I'm going to leave it at that, because I think if I look at the exact wording, I'll understand it a bit better. But at this stage, there's no annuitization for the first year, I'm understanding, for the Providence, for people moving over to just the Providence. Okay, so there is going to be annuitization already for the first couple of contributions on this new thing. And then, so we're actually asking the Providence, or the service provider, to keep record of the contributions that were made prior, with no tax deduction, etc. The poor guys, they're going to cost a couple of million to change their systems for sure. Right. So maybe that's a question we should ask in the industry, because there's such a limited public debate on this, Mr. Chair. Often, can start a distinction between two categories of a provident fund contribution actually be accommodated in short term. And I think the quicker we get, you know, maybe we can think along the lines of allowing a catch-up. Whatever happened in the past, you would then effectively add that to your annualization over a year period to pay it in. You weren't allowed a tax deduction in previous tax years. Perhaps we can, for an next amendment, find a way to catch it up in 3 years from now. Whatever you got in a pension fund balance, whatever you got in a provident fund balance, will be treated in some way. Because I believe very firmly in the concept of simplifying it. In fact, that is far too complicated. And if we can simplify it, it's going to help us in the long run.
Maybe just to focus on the area of manipulations, more on the processes. Looking into the parliamentary schedule, we're supposed to be, this member is supposed to be tabled in the House on the 10th, which is next week. And we are expected, of course, as a committee to support the Mutes Amendment. And we still need also an opinion of our legal team, but also there are political considerations that need to be entertained. So it doesn't give us adequate time, I mean, to cover all these areas appropriately. Now, I'm excited by your announcement, Chair, that we are not going to vote on this matter today. But it also implies that we should then request, because that check with National Treasury on the implication of such a request, that we shift the tabling from the 10th and to move it to, after we are still contacting with National Treasury, move it to the 18th of November. I think that's about us, more than enough time to entertain those two areas. That's my suggestion. But also, I will suggest that because usually, as much as this is a 777, we usually engage the NCOP, the select committee. So if we can get them on board, so as we don't prolong the process. Because if we go through this and we need some more time, it is important that they should also come on board. So when this thing is taken today, it's not prolonged. I think last teacher, National Treasury should ensure that they avail themselves as we entertain more especially this issue of political considerations. That's if there is a need to fear or maybe to be available to make some presentations to our tripartite political caucuses, because it's going to be important to make sure that we intensify our communication at that level, you know. Well, the rest of the matter that as much as there is a positive, realization as a result of, this amendment, more especially to low-income people, there is also the other side to it, you know, how it's going to impact on some of those high ends. And I know majority of those that we are living here, I mean, calling that customer. So it's really important that the National Treasury should avail itself, I mean, for such engagement. Thank you very much.
You know, just think about the content issue.
Because you're very good at tax issues, and clear to me, certainly, and others here, maybe. On the content issues, do you have any views? Remember, at the moment, we're not taking any decision. And it's quite possible within the same party, because we have different technical understanding of issues and come to study different political things. We might just say it's fine. We will meet as a study group and take a collective decision. So it would be nice if you, on the procedure matter, I was thinking about those things. But also you're right, you shouldn't unduly inconvenience the NCOP. There's also another option there we can think about. Those clauses that we don't feel sufficiently confident about, we can just defer till next year or something. But we don't keep deferring them. As somebody said, don't keep the can down the road. But on the substance of what they say about the pension issue, you can offer them sensitive views. What's your view?
I think the rest of the matter that our reliance on the foreign direct investment is mainly, if you look at the federal sector, is a lack of savings that our country is experiencing. Now, we have supported these amendments when they were brought before the committee some years ago. And because of this call for consultation in Netflix, we allow that process, those amendments to be taken back. That we are surprised, personally I'm surprised that there was no consensus, between the big, Labour Federation with National Treasury. Because if you look into the details of it, as much as in some cases it might reduce the disposable income to individuals or households, but the rest of the matter in the long run is going to provide such households, but also it's going to reduce, the this so-called reliance on state assistance beyond return, you know. So these are positive developments, but we really need to make sure that we don't impose, we take our people along, because we are living in a society where most of our people are not that financially literate, you know. And that's why I fully support the foundation by National Security that they have to intensify their communication. Because if you don't do that, you have National Security must fall. I must tell you now. If you don't do that, the trend is here. Hashtag National Security must fall. So we don't want to be, we don't want to be talking to that call. So that's why I'm saying, let's intensify our communication. These issues are not straightforward to our people. We must invest a lot in ensuring that they are properly taken for. Or else, there are so many opportunities. We are just on the eve of local government election. Everyone wants to be a politician. Everyone wants to have an issue that will make him or her happy. So it's very important that as we take this decision in your policy offices, we are very considerate of some of these political implications, you know. Thank you.
Okay, anything else, Mr. Chair, I wasn't there when the submissions on the subject, but I'm quickly reading through them. Yeah. We are only speaking now about the sanitization and this Provident Pension Fund. Are there any other issues? For instance, the case we were speaking about the RNG, I don't see any, I don't see it in yet.
We have a subcommittee set up again in the chair. Look, there is another procedural matter I want to raise. Like, if there's nobody else wants to say anything, Andy, can I say something? Please.
No, because anybody can say, particularly, whatever they are, we don't really...
Okay, no, Chair, my business has not changed. If you remember what I said in the last 2 weeks of all this year, I will try to reflect some of it. Please, the meeting is tried to engage in the people who engaged touched on it. The gist of the matter is not whether people want to reject new amendments in the legislation, because future benefits, it's not there, it's not that issue. The issue is what is happening in the current conjuncture in terms of housing. And I made a suggestion. I said, one, we might want to look at how we make sure that people benefit a certain percentage to relieve them of their they must be forced to come in the house. Right? So it's a very difficult one. It's called adding the consequence at the same time. That people might want to abuse the system itself. At a point we are teaching people how to pay for their retirement. In a particular mandate, it's not a straightforward issue, because you will find a worker who's got three more families living on their family. That's the reach. That is the reach that we make. Now, we might want to lack one of the two options we have to accommodate a situation where we say maybe 1 cent of your pension level retirement contribution will be a cash lump sum, but the rest will go into a niche fund. That's it. I mean, but also handle it in such a way that people should not take advantage now that we should put that they want to retire and take that and use that rather than. Because one, we need to encourage savings in the economy, we need to invest that money for better progress. That will also be part of economic growth. And also remind people, it's not a large community affected. Because there is this juncture in terms of understanding that this government funds contributions and not GPS funds contributions. So when people say it's like everybody's on the bank, it's just not the case. So when we ask for rescheduling, it's basically to take everybody on, but except those who be in the boardroom at NEDEC. Not, I'm saying except those. Because those are the conflicting ones. some of the merit recognition to that. So they want to influence the process on the basis of certain interests and certain political engagement beyond that are not supposed to be here. Influences by how they make the decision work. So PT says it in layman terms, making the constituency to understand this decision. I'm not saying that delay is for the last 6 months or so on the chair, but to unlock that. And I don't hear you saying that, even when you make this presentation now. We have insurance companies here in Grasa. We ask them very pertinent questions in terms of how they sell policies to people. And, you know, when I come to think of what, sorry, the venue of the sector here, old mutual products and assets that says our CEOs invest in the portfolio. Just, you know, that's it. They're trying to impress the, well, I'm with old mutual, I'm not surprised. So, oh, yeah? I'm with you, but I buy a lot of products as well. I was seeing it from a different perspective. From the marketing perspective, how that impacts the moment. But the social responsibility that comes to that remains with us. Because if you take a wrong decision, not wrong as such, but a decision that affects the majority of the poor people, it could certainly affect for us. And you, if you look at the aging of government, it's time to pursue to have a developmental state. This trajectory what is really good because we would have wanted us to have a system like this because we're trying to address what happened in the past. So that is difficult. So the trade off here. So we need to prepare and take everybody on board when it is. So the literary program of what we need to teach people do. Remember the other day I even made a joke. I said, I'm not going to even incentivize, you know, as much as I need. Encourage people to take savings, and I talk about the city dog. I was trying to show you that it's such a small thing to go towards the bigger goal, walking step by step to reach it. So, where is the compromise position in this case? And, you know, death says it as it is, it will be much more challenging. There's this perception that those who deal with this finance don't consider developmental goals of our society when they get to this. They're perception. So they make it very difficult for those who are displaced to take decisions. So we need to always have this neat basket approach in the very challenging time. And it's a matter that doesn't really want us to play to a gallery when we do it. It's a matter where you take your particles, a policy function outside, and look at changes on the ground. Because whatever decision we're going to take here and now, when there's a different reaction to it, we'll be able to come to this drawing board and reverse that decision. Now, we take the industrial board, we take everybody at work and we say, can we come with a solution? A solution that we address the realities that we have now. So that we don't see people chasing again. So no, let's go. And they go to the field of unemployed. And then we have a gap for the teaching profession where they refuse to pedagogue and we have to go again, take people to voluntary service packages to come back to the industry. Or indefinite facilities, for instance. Because don't be happy. I can tell, okay, kids, I know where people just have to get handed back into. Because of the shortages of skills. Process where you can have new people from college that doesn't mean they are skilled enough, you know, they are effective to certain things. You know. I know, for instance, if I can make an example, Philadelphia Hospital is known to be the best trauma hospital in the entire country. And if you go to Philadelphia Hospital, you realize that actually most of the people like there are over the age of 6. The last time I was there. So those are things. So we take them into account, we try to put them in. Then we can, once we have that we can move forward. I think we will. We've done a lot of work so far already, but we need to suffuse in this situation.
Anybody else wants to come in, contribute me? Prime Minister.
Sorry, Mr. Chair. I'm just thinking again about, do we really want the two to be the same? Forget the tax side of it. I mean, at the end of the day, you're going to set up, giving the public effectively one choice. You're going to stay towards one type of the other. At the moment, there's a difference in the tax, so basically a guy's choice as to how he wants to do it. What's happened as a consequence is because it's easy to set up a problem fund. Employers have gone and set up problem funds of a pension fund. And now, because of this imbalance, we've forced it to fix this tax topic. The original purpose of having two different types of schemes were, one, you get a lump sum, and you get that lump sum and you you have a tax on it. The other, was the reason to have the two different, and do we really want to, from a, take away the choice from the industry and from people to go decide how they want to save for the future? And I think, Mr. Chair, if possible, maybe we can ask the input from the industry about the two administration systems and whether it's in everybody's interest to actually have almost one type of retirement saving product in the long term.
Mm-hmm.
Just
a quick question. I'm just going to say something different from what the other members have said. But the issue of consultation, I think, is very crucial. When we actually had a meeting with the GPA, there was a whole lot of concerns, and we made it clear to them that it's very important for them to consult, more so to us as public reps. And this other issue that the Honorable Tandy has made an example of, the issue of public servants riding from work, you know, because there was this perception that the government is going to temper or interfere with their pension and all that. And if those things are not addressed in time, they become reality. And people, when they react, we are left with problems to deal with them. And the minister has to run around to, you know, try to intervene and address issues. And we are saying this time we need to do it correctly and not try to cure the situation. We rather prevent the situation. You know, prevention is better than cure. And Honorable Cindy has suggested that we should have eight virtues. And nine virtues. I know each time I speak, things become so exciting. So, just question. So the non-causes, I think, I'm thinking of the comments like Zimbana or the Sofia. So if you are going to have one virtue in a province, so you rather go and have a unique strategy whereby you go to find something suitable. But also the need for community issues will assist in doing that. It is very, 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 very important. Because this thing that we're talking about, last year when we just came in, some parties of COVID lost the perception in the house. Even though we knew it's not here, we tried to clear it up, but they situation and made a lot of noise about it and make it look like that government is of course going to take your own for paid, your kitchen, if you don't resign now. And the example that has been given of nurses and teachers, those are scarcely. So we are finding ourselves one and having a problem. So Chair, I think it's very important that we take our time. But also like what you said about the public room. We don't trust what the treasurer might bring here to us after consultation. But it will also help us to make important decisions when we have interactions with those bodies. Thank you.
Chair,
over
to
you. Thank you, Chair. No, I think hearing all the honourable members, I think we'll all agree that, you know, life is complex.
And there's no way that government can fully protect people or determine the choices or understand choices that people have to make. And I think many of the issues here, just to remind honorable members, we have raised, we had a more comprehensive session on retirement reform. Now, on the one hand, we get criticized that it's piecemeal, social security reform. It's almost an understanding to solve all the other problems in society from that perspective. And I can tell you, not that it's any insider info, but no social security reform paper is going to be the panacea and solve all our problems. That's why what you said is, let's focus on those people who are working and who are saving through their retirement. And how do we actually deal with them? How can we make things better? And in a sense, if you delay changes, it perhaps only serves those who are currently benefiting from whatever perspective, okay? And that the actual benefit to members is actually minimized, okay? So we're not trying to go and do this in one massive step. A lot of the issues that have been raised, or some of the issues, we then dealt with in that presentation to try and show where things fit in. So let's take the question of provident versus pension fund. You know, we're not even trying to say the one is phased out. We're just saying they are going to become equal. You can call it what you like. If you want to look at other options, if you just go back, that we can make the papers we made available from Alana 2012. So part of this was not only to push people into retirement state, but to get non-retirement state, okay? And when I say life is complex, people need to decide how much they want to put into long-term savings, how much into short-term, and of course, you don't know whether you're going to be employed or not employed. There's a lot of uncertainty. And that's why we brought in tax-free savings. And perhaps some people want to save, you want to make sure upfront that's what they save for. But if you want a situation where you want to take your money out any time, you actually then are working against the interests of those in the same fund who want to save longer, because the nature of investments will be more short term rather than longer term. Okay, so there's a lot of trade-offs that go on. And getting back to the theme of complexity, the point is, in the financial sector, for ordinary middle class and poorer people, there are too many choices. There are too many funds. That means big fees for all the people who administer. Okay, you want to consolidate, you want to have fewer, you want to have simpler. Boutique products are for the high income market. But can we get a simpler arrangement? So if you look at our retirement reform and you make it available, the presentation, we have, you know, gone into governance, into, there's a lot of problems that you have currently, trustees, what role they play, etc. And certainly when you deal with communication here, the point is this, trustees have to communicate with their members and they don't. That is the first instance of communication that you need, okay? There's a dependency on trustees on the administrators. People become trustees but they're dependent on the administrators. There are power asymmetries here. Okay. These are complex issues that you need to deal with. Now, let's deal with the issue of GPF and resignations. The GPF is not affected one search by the reforms after 2013. Because they are a pension fund. There's no change. There's no additional benefit from a tax perspective. So they don't get better regime than others. They are a normal pension fund. Yes, it is a defined benefit pension fund, which has its own sort of issues there, and the liability resides with government as in its capacity as employer, not in its capacity as government. Okay. So when people resign, I mean, and we've gone into this, we've checked. Initially, people were saying lots of people are resigning all over the place. We found, sure, you're always going to find a handful resigning all over the place. But essentially, it was members of GPF. And we attribute this, and not that we can prove these things, to two factors. One,
that the GP has just started giving us benefit statements, okay, just a few months before the resignation. So I can tell you, just being a manager, people would come and they say, wow, I've got 400,000 rand, it's a lot of money, okay. And that is indebted. Our initial studies, and I've asked the committee if we can come and present on indebtedness, because we've done a lot of work this summer. It's a crisis, Chair. It's a crisis, okay, which we need to deal with. It's not only students who, on a student debt, may be getting over indebted. It's a general problem that we have, and we have to deal with it. And the problem with the indebtedness story is that apparently public servants are more indebted than even minors in the national. And that's because, I guess, we have more security of in the job. So it means all the vouchers target public servants and try and load you with more debt. And everybody tries to get the debt as soon, as high up in the chain, as early in the chain as possible. So that's why Garnity Corp issues those orders, the monument assessment orders, are part of their business model. They know you won't pay, then you get a garnishy order, which means they'll get paid first. People were playing the system, if they don't get advice on getting you at the point of payroll, so an order, monument assessment order, then they go into, as soon as that money is put into your bank account and you have ADO and NADO payment systems with the staff sort of regulate, they all come early in the chain. Now, we're not going to solve all these problems like if we want to keep one big elephant, okay? We're going to chop this up and see how do you deal with the various problems. So coming back to the time reform that we have, this is not a new issue. As I said, there were papers before, and it got legislated in 2013. So I sense members are feeling nervous because perhaps coming, it's almost like push comes to shove, okay? But in a sense, not going ahead, I think has brought all kinds of other risks and uncertainty. And I think that we've gone the extra 10 miles to here, okay? So let's take issues that have been raised, which are not new issues, and certainly doesn't mean they shouldn't be raised because they were raised before. The issue of savings, here it's a concern to us. Olam can tell you just now all the measures we've taken to stimulate savings, including the tax-free savings product which got implemented on the 1st of April this year. If there are issues related to Edna, they can contradict what I say. And in fact, we will make all the submissions, we will just check with people unless they have objections. But they shouldn't. We want to make that all available. Certainly to members of the committee, so you can see exactly what in that list people are saying. Okay. I think that most of the administrators are saying, actually, you know, we were veering towards some of those option two approaches, but I think that, you know, they think that's the worst option. Yes, some are less bad than others, but they feel overwhelmingly that we should go for the option that we plan for. And there isn't a problem really in the back office administering different tax-free for this date, after that date. It's better than if we delay, they can have to possibly create different funds, so you can have more fragmentation of members' pension funds. You don't want to confuse members of pension funds, okay, or provident funds, which tend to be the people dealing with either lower to middle income. So certainly, when you look at our twin peak reforms, it is about getting simpler products, products that people understand. And communication is about financial education, and certainly when you change a law, we need to go out and explain, and it's at various levels. So yeah, coming back to the specific issue, and I'll ask the rest of the team just to come on the specifics, but because we want simplification, we're also going for what we call better default in the system. So we have a related process where we put out regs, which we hope to get through early next year, which says that for example, when members retire, it's not the point to leave them to everybody, the vouchers. And the vouchers are not just industry and so on, or people trying to sell them policies. And let me say, industry is not one uniform group either. There are different interests that you may have, the people who sell, the people who actually, etc. Do family members, suddenly you have more family members around you, you have a lot of friends, okay, and
you know, stories are endless about how the people don't know how to handle this big lump sum and what actually happens to them, okay? So how paternalistic should the state be is a big issue. But we are saying to funds, can you ensure that you provide a default annuity product, okay? So that people are always defaulted into the right default. People leave a job, don't get the HR department to just lay you out, and you get taxed and you don't even know it. Put it in a federation fund and say, you need to get a FICA document and your go to a financial advisor to take your money out. So at least there's a bit of a delay. You still have it. It's yours in your name. So there's quite a lot of thinking about a better and more intelligent design system. But just because you have a better system doesn't mean that you will get necessarily better outcomes. It doesn't mean that you won't get perverse outcomes. It doesn't mean that people will not get confused. And therefore, communication, financial education are critical too. So I would just say those are the broad issues that we need to deal with. I think this bigger issue of savings. Yes, we want savings, but you can't, there's a point at which, yeah, whether you say 350, 450, 500,000, where do you draw the line and limit? Okay? At the moment it's unlimited. Okay? I don't believe that means there'll be less savings. There'll be less retirement-related savings, perhaps. But sure, there are risks, and people could save less and collect, so they could save more elsewhere. Okay? So there are those risks, and a lot of these issues were there at the time. And frankly, that's not been the area that's been contested largely. I think, yes, even in the 60s, saying, can't you increase the threshold? We said, look, that's a separate process. Give us your thoughts. We can look at it for the next budget. It's still implementation before 1st of March, the budget, and so on and so on. But let's get on with the immunization. And if we went ahead with the tax provision, which we want to go ahead with, okay, the problem is you introduce all kinds of problems on the annuitization front. More problems we have with this. And that's why we felt that, look, we've given a long enough period in terms of consultations. We've heard people, yes, some may never get full agreement on some of these issues. It is a judgment call. And the judgment call is, let's proceed. The benefit to members is undoubtedly so powerful that I think that we would not be, in a sense, exercising our broader fiduciary responsibility to members in broad sense. I don't know if you want to answer or not some of the other questions that came in.
Thanks, Momo. I'll try and very quickly answer some of the questions. So the question around provident funds and pension funds being the same, so I think our sense there, Chair, that if you have a retirement vehicle whose aim should be, will be to provide a retirement benefit, then arguably you want all those retirement vehicles to look the same. So ideally, when it comes to retirement, you want people to be able to have a decent benefit when they get to retirement. That's the best step. And once they're in retirement, you want to help them to continue getting a regular income up until they pass on. So I think once you agree to those principles, in a way they explain why it's important to have all types of retirement vehicles being the same. But there's also context to that. So our understanding around how provident funds have emerged relates also to the concerns workers had with existing pension funds, which were largely DB funds, and the opaqueness associated with the DB funds. So one of the ways to deal with that was for members to say, well, let's have more transparent funds. So that's the reason why most, if not all, of your provident funds tend to be DB, defined contribution funds. And that was to deal with some of the opaqueness. There's also an important member protection issue, which I think we haven't also thought about. So when you read some of the scams that you see around in the country, you realize how they target pensioners. And chances are that it's far much easier targeting a pensioner who has got a large sum pension benefit vis-a-vis someone who's going to get a regular income. So in a way, by getting members into a pension fund system where there is a regular income, to a large extent, you also start protecting those members against fraud targets. Chair, then there was the question around social security and synchronizing within Treasury. So I think that's the difficulty, but we happen to have seen what in the social security paper, and yes, other people haven't seen it. And yes, that creates sort of, you know, an unfortunate disadvantage for those who haven't seen. But actually, we can reasonably assure you that we have ensured that there is alignment with what we are doing now and what you might end up with 3, 5 years, 10 years down the line. Or a few months. So I'm thinking about ultimately the system itself, the outcome, yes. So we have tried to align. I think the important point to make is that either way you go, whether you will end up with a national fund or you piggyback on the current retirement system, you are still going to need the current system. So the current system is not going to necessarily disappear because you have a much more comprehensive national security system. So it means then it's better for you to fix some of the cracks in the current system so that once you roll out the broader system, then at least you are able to build on a much more solid ground.
Yeah, I think I hope I've answered some of the questions. I don't know, Chris, if they might have
answered. I think there were just a couple. One on the comments on have we met industry. We met them on the 30th of November, Friday, and we had long consultations with them in person, going through the different options, the problems with them. And we hopefully got a lot of those, their concerns in person. A lot of them were then written down after they've given them permission that we can get them from us. And with their permission, then you can see the details behind it. And then there are some wordings on the 50,000 and the legislation, but I'm talking those through that in the course of thought. And I mean, the main point really is to make that the DCS isn't impacted at all from the annuitization fund. They're really annuitized. There's a defined benefit fund where you get a 6.7% gratuity when you resign, and the rest is an income based on how long you've been in the GETS and your final salary. And these annuitization requirements don't impact that at all. The only thing that you might be getting is a higher tax deduction, which would mean an increase that you've got more available to contribute to your retirement annuity fund if you would like to.
Certainly, I think on consultations, I think we hope that they are genuine. So it's not just that we receive submissions. So Chris has talked about one meeting, but even before the consultation, we had a meeting, and I must thank the industry. They were there within 2 days notice, okay, very short notice. Certainly with the unions, we've met with them individually. The minister also convened a MEDLAC labor constituency meeting on the Friday just after the HPPS. So there's been meetings taking place. And I think that we are, and let me say, given where we differ with people, it's not that we won't continue to engage. I think that the point is we need to move forward, and just given that you, for example, have the vested rights, hardly any worker is going to be affected next year with annuitization, because it's going to take a heck of a long time to reach the threshold of 247,500. And let me say, members also, I think, we're confusing some of the numbers, but that number is going to explain the two numbers before I get it done.
Our apologies, Chair, for you being dangerous.
I understand
that, but I don't use terms that I'm claiming. Obviously because I'm here so long, but it's a terrible term to use. But anyway, explain it simply, how would you say
that? Sure, there might be. So the 247,500 That is that, you know, if you grow your assets, so if you're a Provident Fund member and from next year you contribute, and your contribution from after next year, so only those future contributions grow, and your assets on those contributions grow to something greater than 247,500, only then will you be required to annuitize. The 350,000 is a limit on the tax deduction you will get on a contribution in any particular year. So it's up to the greater of 27.5% the greater tax point more remuneration, or 350,000.
So, Chair, those are the numbers. And obviously we can talk about, you know, what level it should be. Should it be higher? Should it be lower? If we talk to the industry, for example, I think the preference would be that it's lower, because then more people have to annuitize. Now, on the issue of annuities, there are issues about what's the appropriate annuity, what are the charges. I mean, I think all of those are also areas that we're looking at and which need to be also solved. And certainly, as I said, we have got in parallel staff relations, and we are consulting with industry, so we extended the deadline. So there's a lot of reforms going through. We released, for example, a major paper on charges, okay, which inform the approach we're taking on these default bags that we have. So certainly, I mean, I'd like to think that, and even I think our credibility and our reputation, that we do consult with exhaustively, and even with those that we differ, that we will still continue to engage them. And if there are problems, because there always are possible perverse outcomes, we can deal with it at the time. So we think, yes, the tax limits take effect next year, 1st of March, and the annuitization, though it takes effect the 1st of March next year, in reality, people will only begin to feel its effect, depending on their income, in year 2 or year 3 or much later. And there's a period where the entire reform would take 40 years, before everyone in one fund, and there's no two amounts within a fund.
Sorry, Chair, I just wanted to add another comment around the communication. So I was going to share that you actually had two groups of people last year going through this resignation trend. And I think you might still experience that going forward. So it's quite important to understand the dynamic between the two. So there's definitely a group which was misinformed, which unfortunately didn't have accurate information and reacted on false rumors, etc. And those you can deal with via proper, accurate, extensive communication. Then there's a group, Chair, which I think, irrespective of what you tell them, how accurate the message is, how truthful you will be in your message, they will still continue resigning. And simply because if someone is indeed dead and they don't have any other source of saving except their retirement savings, unfortunately, they will end up having to resign and exiting. So I think it's important then going forward that, yes, we will do our utmost best to get the communication right, to deal with the former, but you might still see the latter group persisting, and you must, I would say, one will need to accept that that's the reality, and unfortunately you won't be able to reach out to everyone. Thanks, Chair.
Actually, I'm going to make a quick market in this issue. I'm going to local government issues. I'm going to try to lobby everybody in the board group to vote for my party, and I'll explain why. I want you to vote for my party because it's the only party in the entire world where you find that colonizers coexist with those who liberated the people from colonizers and still come up with policies that encapsulate everybody. So I ask you to vote for the African National Congress.
Okay, so can I rule that that is a one decision we're taking in the committee today? And can you minute that, and can we have follow-up, Linda, issue the press statement, okay? Right, okay, then Brandon?
Jay, can we use any longer quick to make sure I understand it exactly?
let's say before I become a member of parliament as a wealthy man, and as of February 2016, I have 2 million rand in my province fund. 1 million was contributed by a company and 1 million by myself towards that. February 27, I'm not a member of parliament, I'm earning a decent salary of 3 bar a year. I contribute 350, whatever it is, back to 350,000 rand for my own money, and I don't have an employer anymore, so I have no additional money. So now my total fund is 2.35 million. And then in March 2017, I resign. This time I'm old enough to resign. I will get the 2 million, no, the 250,000, 247,500 of that will come to me as a lump sum, correct? And then the balance over 247,500, which is the 350,000, will have to then be a new annual pass, or the whole 350,000 will be a new pass. But then the 2 million I had from before, that gets back to me as a lump sum, still the old rules. So the only question then, I seem to be looking large, is 350,000. As soon as you go over 247,500, the whole amount will be annualized, not a portion of your like 2 million is a tax-free amount. Well, no, yeah, it's tax-free. No, it's not tax-free. No,
if I may, maybe Chris should come in. The 350 is at your annual deduction. Okay. The 247 is not going to be an annual amount. It's what you finally save, and at the point at which it's treated, that
the bit of yeah, so I mean there's a couple things there. If you resign, you're not retiring, you resign, you can take the whole thing again. If you are retiring, and that's preservation which we must deal with, if you are retiring, the 2 million is a vested right. So it's in the provident fund, so you wouldn't have to utilize any equipment there. The additional 350,000 contribution after 1 March 2016 is now part of the new regime. Okay. Since that 350,000 is above the 247,500, you will have to annuitize. And then you annuitize two-thirds of that. And you get a third as a lump sum. And at retirement, the lump sum tax table, you get up to 500,000 as tax-free, so you wouldn't pay any tax on that amount.
So what this alluded to, at the moment, there was a funny system, okay, because of the reservation loophole. So you, even it's there with GPF, with any pension fund, you know, let's say it says you can take it at age 60, okay? When you reach 59 years and 11 months, you resign, you take the whole amount. If you wait till, say, 60 years, which could be a retirement age, you have to annuitize. So we do need to deal with that reservation problem. Okay, that's a loophole that's there, which wasn't intended. And when I say we're not doing it through the back door, we will raise those issues. And let me say, when in raising the issue, we're not calling also for 100% reservation. This is where the unions come in. They say, no, that's a problem because people become unemployed and you live like a pauper, but you want to then say you must die like a king, okay, in retirement, okay? Which made a lot of sense to us. But we say, hold on, let's be proportionate. You shouldn't be able to withdraw the entire amount. First, perhaps you should go to the IF. Then you can say you withdraw, I don't know, 1% per month for a year. And yes, maybe at some point, you know, you just put some pedals. But if you just take the entire amount in one go, I think that you get, it's out of proportion. So we think, let there be some proportionality. And nobody is talking 100% annuitization, 100% reservation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. There are a number of questions that I don't think you have dealt with. The first is, in these consultations, real consultations, is the industry ready and prepared to implement on 1st of March 2016? And if you chair will allow that, that would be great. Then the question of the 350,000 capping. Now, I think the motivation has been a vertical subsidization. And Mirma, you yourself said that the consequences likely to be people will not take the additional money for a doctor. That's going to be the likely thing. But even if they didn't, can you explain to me how this vertical cost subsidization can be hampered? I don't understand it, and maybe a silly question that we are now encouraged to ask. I don't understand this vertical productization. In any event, I don't see it happening because once most of us hit 350, we're going to find other ways of saving that money in a more lower tax free if we can. And that might be offshore as well. So the industry will answer that question about the timing and the readiness of it. The question of option one is that the option that you discussed with industry, or that subsequent to having that consultation in the last week, that you now come and share with option one as a consequence of that consultation? Or did you go to industry with option one and say that's what we're going to propose? Or did you go saying, listen, we think we're going to have to go to 2B, what do you guys want? And then I assume that from what Chris is saying, most said they wanted option one, and now you've changed your position to option one. So that, please, if I could, on that one. And then the possibility of if there are insurmountable implementation problems for the industry, the possibility of going with the suggestion in your press release of 2014 of delaying to 2017.
I just want members in particular, I will call on industry first more because maybe you can respond. But I just want some ground rules to be understood, right, about inviting people to speak. We've done it with all the studies and stuff, our committees I've shared before, and increasingly I think the committee is agreeing, we need to have an activistic parliament. There are also some, like for example, what we did, just to alert those of you who are here from civil society or business or industry, what we did was, which we haven't done before, is we said, okay, you don't make submissions, then National Treasury reply, then you get a chance to reply, then National Treasury reply. So we've already opened up quite a bit. Secondly, we asked to set up an umbrella structure. But then you realize you can't set up an umbrella structure because you have competing interests, sometimes directly contradictory interests. But we accept that. Thirdly, you see, we've got industry here, but don't have the trade union. And that makes me feel uncomfortable. And others of our stakeholders, you know, there may be NGOs that are relevant. So we kind of get another public ear. But so it's understood that there's not always and in every circumstance that we will. It's regrettable that for starting there, no submission. To ask when we put this, these bills up for public hearing. However, what I'm saying is that, you know, Momo, before we used to ask, I'm sure Hans is going to think, we asked the executive to give us all submissions made to them on bills that the gazette, and local government didn't hold those that they gazette. So they would give it to us. They didn't tell us we have to ask for permission. Because there are market sensitivities here. Maybe it's a different portfolio where you need definition. But I would like, I mean, not why, we would like to deal with you. We'd like to miss Sami, this is by the way, send her apology. She's very old working, she's been engaged now in international relationships, she's not here. So we would like all the submissions. We'd like to go to South Korea and so on. And those who are saying, hey, defer this, you know. So we invite you to speak. Now, there's so many of you here. I'm not sure how we manage this process. So maybe you're going to do it like, do you want to have us on that panel? Who speaks? I don't know. If each of you speaks 5 minutes, then we're not going to leave here. Can't even answer this question. Let me speak a little bit to you.
Yeah, I'm not going to suggest a process not to allow the sector to speak, but if you consider like that, if we say those who are present must speak, then it means we left create space for those who are not yet.
Yes, I agree, definitely.
And we did the part here where we took into account the views of the sector and we requested the consultation to respond to that, and we are in the process where we now as the committee are moving forward based on the sector recommendations, the national recommendations. Maybe I made a joke when I was talking about today. I was trying to say, even if I say realizer knows that our government tried to incorporate different views into one to make sure that when we deal with matters of this nature,
we don't only look at one sector at the expense of the other to a point that we are seen as an innocent. But we are trying to, you know, to bring these two traders together. It's a very complex environment. So I don't envisage a situation where we open up public hearing, because then if we prolong, we will have to re-invite everybody who had views before. And I know they are here, it will be, it has been better in the, you know, but if the engagements were there, let's get the report from the Slaughter on those reports.
Yeah.
And then we, that's my suggestion.
No, I agree with you. I agree.
There's no discipline what you're saying, but here there are some practical issues that are being asked. It's about the readiness and so on, right? And they write here. Those are like issues we didn't raise in the hospital because, I'm agreeing with you, but saying because of the exceptional circumstances, we should allow it a limited response on the practical issues that arise about, are you ready to do this? Maybe you push it in any case, or why would you call it? And that's useful. But you are right. You know, what you're saying, not mutual excuse, but I agree with you, Andy. Shall we just quickly, you want to say something?
I just was going to say, we want to get the industry. I think a CISA could be said to represent the industry, and maybe Rosemary Reisbody, who's here from the CISA, can say whether she thinks she can also, I'm not sure if you also represent the payroll administrators, because there's a range of people involved, but a CISA would represent the
industry. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, committee. I will be very brief. The questions that were asked, we represent all the administrators, the pension fund product suppliers and administrators. Payroll administrators, not all of them, but to the extent that our members, being corporates, many of them have their own payroll system, to that extent I can speak for them. As far as systems readiness is concerned, our members, because the bill before the current bill, the 2013 bill, having provided for a 1 March 2016 implementation date, they are either ready or in the process, well down the road. They have spent the money, they've spent the resources, they are busy getting ready. And any changes of any of substance will mean they will have to rework all of that again to undo, and they're very concerned should that be the outcome. So and the next question is consultation. National Treasury did consult with us on all the options that have been put in these slides that have been circulated. It was a very comprehensive consultation with many of our members themselves present, and there was robust discussion, and the option one that is being suggested today is very, very strongly supported by industry. And so far as seeing our position is concerned, we would be very happy if Trudy would share that with the committee. Thank you.
Okay. More quickly, more. Yeah. Okay. I don't think we need to ask people. I think we just make them available, because when people submit, I know Chris put the qualifier, but I think he was just being cautious. But that is no problem at all. Okay. I think Rosemary's answered the issue that we put all the options forward. I think there was a question also on the macro issue of 50,000. It's not a cross-subsidization issue. There's always a bit of that, I guess. It's really a case of equity between high and low income, so virtual equity, as you call it. And it's about how much tax do you want high-income persons to forego, because what they get deduction for, in a sense, doesn't come into the business. You know, it's a judgment call. You can say 350, 450, 550. And in any case, I think generally people will still find other vehicles to stay in. Some might exercise offshore, onshore, but I think that most people, I don't think that, yeah, it might change the composition of your thing.
Actually, if I could just add to what Mohammed said. So yes, it's probably difficult to say whether the number should be 350 or 355 or 360, but we did some research in terms of getting to the 350, and what motivated the 350k was to have a threshold which will be as less disruptive as possible. So our numbers, Steph and Chris can come into, at the time when we ran them,
give us the impression that the most of your members should be accommodated by the reforms. Of course, you are higher income individuals who fall on the other side, but by and large, most of the members would be fairly within the 350,000.
Okay. Yeah, I'll round up. Jim, thank you very much to Rose for that input and help, certainly helps me make a decision, and thanks for the other responses. There's one issue that I forgot to call it up on a minute ago, and I understand the GPEA has no impact in terms of the new accommodation, but does the capping apply there as well? The 350.
Yes, well, the equity applies to anyone. So, but remember that for most of us, I don't think GPEA will reach even there. So what you do is, you know, you might exhaust, say, 20%, okay? The rest of it you can buy retirement annuity. So some other retirement product. That's what you would do.
I'm being put down. And you can't roll over the unused portion.
Yes, so, I mean, there are two things about this cap that you're aware of. If you go above it, you can roll over and deduct it next year if you've got it. So it's quite generous in that way. And also, you won't get a deduction now, but when you retire, and any amount that were above the cap, you don't pay tax on when you receive it. So it's just the timing of the tax take rather than double.
Okay. Can I
try
to
you can help me summarize where I think we are. To a large extent, I think the majority of us, or almost all of us, are saying we understand the goals. We broadly agree with the proposals. There's some technical aspects we may not be all convinced about or even understand fully, but broadly the thrust of your proposals are. I think what people are saying is that it's not the merits per se of the proposal. It's the volatility of the situation we are in. 1.5% growth rate, job losses looming in the mining and steel industries and so on. With the level of equity indebtedness that you know more about than we do, in technical terms, we still need to know constituency and other work. But so do you, I mean your family and so on, you're an MP. To feel that pressure. It's because of all of those things that we're a bit cautious, not so much about the specific merits of the thing. And we would like, I think, it's a place for one thing to say here, a bit of time. And so obviously we're going to vote today. What we would like in the first instance is the PDO to look at the submissions that have come together. We can pull a research team together. So you're coming on top of the and look a bit more carefully and see whether there's no room for some measure of compromise, or if we do proceed as you're proposing, and as we probably agreeing, you know, that we handle this matter in a way that ensures that as much as the proposals are good and the intentions are noble, they don't get overwhelmed by a whole lot of responses, negative responses to it, right? And I think the students marching last week have also understandably made MPs across all political parties cautious about not managing constituencies out there sensibly and sensitively. So, you know, I can understand your frustration, Momo, and your team. Not immediately frustrating. I don't know the background of other people, but you're an activist until very recently, 1994. You're an activist in a different right? And you know, it's all about perception politics. It's 70% perception, 30% content, you know that. You've only believed about this is 90% perception and 10% content. Right? So, I mean, really, we are politicians. I mean, we were in your shoes, as it were. It's entirely possible we would take your position. But if you were in our shoes, you would also probably feel the same way. So, we need a bit of time. We're not saying no, we just need a bit of time. And we need to know exactly what we think. Not in terms purely of the content of your proposal, but in political management. So I think it's reasonable to say the majority will probably agree that we can't wait for the social sector reform paper. I think I've already answered my question, which is your set of proposals reasonably consistent with what is likely to emerge in the reform of the social security system? And you said yes, you know, you already said yes. I don't think we can agree with that, but don't do anything until the whole package emerges. That could take some while. So I don't think the majority will agree with that proposal. Then I wanted to say, you see, there's a lot of frustration that some of us have here, and maybe the chairman in particular, because ultimately he's responsible for the committee, is you know, actually all of us in trouble. It's just too far. I mean, this actual whole MGBC, whole Michael's Act process. I mean, to come to Parliament last week Wednesday, then you guys run with your public hearings, engagements with civil society and industry and so on the tax bills that are very complex, and we have to vote within 5 or 6 days or a week, then we'll go to the NCOP and then Parliament goes. So there are all those frustrations we have, if you think you're frustrated, right? I think this point to the time frame, and I'll let me go back on it now. He is only one. Me, Ali Shah now is to take and to speak to Liberty about who the date back of that. But I would like to suggest that, you know, that maybe, I don't know what members feel, do we think there's a need for this, that we set up a small subcommittee of one or two ANC, one TA, fine. In that case, it's not a major party, political, you know, four people, three people. Preston Rodriguez, I'm going to say, so I think in this committee, certainly on the majority party side, is most conversant with tax issues. And there is a sitting on Friday, where we're looking at ITA and the conflict stuff. We can find some time there for the subcommittee to meet, or you can meet talk to me. And we can next Tuesday also find a slot there. Minister, by the way, is in, I think somebody has to tell him to Turkey next week. If you recall, we agreed that we'll have the SAA here on Tuesday. We are negotiating today. Whatever happens, we will see SAA before the term ends, okay? So there may be a slot there. So whatever happens by next Tuesday, we will have to hold the building, whatever form it is. Or thereabouts. Let's just deadline finish our work. On the issue of, okay, I think I'll stop there. Is that, the issue of money goes at now. Frank, you have to help us today on how we manage that part. Let us be addressed now. But for now, is that a reasonable summary? Does somebody want to add to that? Give it more depth.
I understand this thing of the subcommittee, but the other matter is that the matters are a bit clearer to members now. Usually at the subcommittee there are issues that are not that clear. My biggest concern is, as earlier indicated, the time that we need to deal with political consideration, but also of course, I'm not sure. Then I'm going to give advocate against some ideas because it's really important, I mean, for us to accommodate this advice, you know. But those are the two cases that are of major ones. So, well, I think we will discuss about the proposed delay for adoption because we might have to squeeze in some of the processes before that day, you know. Very good.
All right. Mr. Chairman, I think we were due to go line by line today with the assistance of National Treasury and France. Are we suggesting it's not going to happen, that it's going to happen in a subcommittee? And will the subcommittee then have the assistance of National Treasury and France to be able to do that? Because there's a lot of lines to go through.
Yeah, well, the way I understand a subcommittee is that it has the same powers as the committee, except it can't actually take the final decision. So it'll come to the committee and say we've been through the bill, this is what we pick up, etc. And they can meet while the House is sitting and so on. National Treasury will have to make its full team available, as would be in any committee situation. Those issues are, it's the norm, so there's no difference, only in a smaller committee, work faster. The committee's brief would be to do those things, but also to, despite our party political differences, we won't agree on this, how to politically manage the thing. And you don't think you can sit here in a big committee to meet with. So, yes, I'd like you to still keep open your mind to a subcommittee. But if the majority is on a subcommittee, it's fine. If there's, you don't chair the subcommittee, I prefer you do, I'm happy to chair it. I'll do it. You know, but here's me more competent than me, I suspect. But I think you're right. But broadly, apart from the subcommittee idea, is that a reasonable summary of where we are? Yeah. Is that fine? Okay.
Right.
Yeah, we're coming to that now. Yeah, I was saying for now, we're going to look through the other issues as well. Brandon?
So, Mr. Chair, why don't we get started with the subcommittee meeting now?
You can decide as a subcommittee when you want to meet, and I will negotiate with the powers that be in Parliament. But you come back to that in a moment. Can we have Frank brief us now?
I just want to confirm. The reduction in the revenue base for the country has already been budgeted for or not? Because the effect of it, it's been delayed from this year, so it won't be yet in the budget. But obviously it's dropped in revenue. What's the estimated drop in revenue? Because the individual taxation is directly going to fall as a result of these amendments, which now allow more tax deductibility for individuals. Now, an estimate how much it's going to cost for them, because there's more money to add to the education shortfall.
How old are you?
Who are
you?
But I mean, our numbers have assumed of implementation of existing legislation. That's what the legislation says.
We haven't done a new study for that dynamic that we looked at it previously.
Okay, can we have Frank now, please?
Thank you, Chairperson, honourable members and guests. Chair, there's two sections in the Money Bills Amendment Procedure Act which one must take notice of. One is the so-called fiscal rules in Section 8.5, which applies quite specifically to the fiscal framework or the fiscal position of the country, which requires that any decision, and it's specific there, refers to revenue bills, refers to other money bills. Section 8, subsection 5.
Yeah.
The money bills.
Yeah.
Those are the so-called fiscal rules. And it depends if there's a change in the fiscal position. So when Parliament, not the executive, but when Parliament makes a decision to amend a revenue bill, as is the case in this instance, we must make sure that we comply with those fiscal rules. They are pliable, they are not carved to concrete or set in stone. But it requires that the report to the House must at least refer to them to say that these rules are being complied with. And clearly we need to make sure that we comply with those, which brings us to the point which was raised at this, just now, either a change in the fiscal position for this fiscal year. If there is, we must make sure that such an amendment must comply with the present revised fiscal framework that we are going to adopt today, as far as I know. If there's a change in the fiscal position in the outer 2 years, in the medium-term expenditure framework, we need to report that. That's my interpretation of S5. And to say whether such change is reasonable when you compare the long-term effects of that change in fiscal position. So, Chair, it would be important, in my view, and I don't want to put my colleagues of Treasury on this, but we need to know what the result is going to be of these amendments that is being proposed to the committee. So the fiscal effect will have. The other section must take note of is Section 11 that deals specifically with a revenue bill. In short, those provisions in Section 11 is aimed at, do we change a revenue bill? Are we making tax collection more difficult? Are we applying equity and equality amongst taxpayers? Again, not fixed rules, it's tribal rules, but let's make sure that we don't, as Parliament, create basically a new policy that affects the way we collect revenue across the country. That being said, I need to explain that the aim of this Act was always for Parliament to act on its oversight duty rather than to create new policy in terms of the fiscal and specifically in Section 11, the revenue issues. So we don't create new tax policy, but that we look at something and say, well, there is a problem in terms of our oversight function and therefore we want to change it. In this instance, what we have today is we're seeing proposals by National Treasury. So, that being the case, it's still the committee that makes the amendments. So the committee must take care of Section 11 and to ensure that the revenue raised is consistent still, again at that point, that comes from 85. Either a change in the revenue that we are raising for this revised fiscal framework, if so we need to report it. Doesn't bar us from it, but we need to report it. Take in account the principles of equity and efficiency. Specifically, we must look at the impact on development, investment, employment, and economic growth. Now, Chair, I think what we need to do is at least report these things to the House to say that these have been taken into consideration, but it's not the evidence base. And the only other procedural issue is, of course, giving the Minister an opportunity to respond to the amendments of the committee. In this case, I think we've got that already, seeing that the Minister is proposing these amendments. And that's about it, Chairperson, but we need that evidence to see what is the impact of these amendments. By shifting the dates specifically. Thank you, Chair.
Okay, basically, just going to respond to that. James and then Al.
Yeah, but I'm not a lawyer. Some of this is making sure that our approach might be challenged if we don't respond to the provision of this contract. Now, I just wanted to know, because the National Federation, obviously, thinks that they are better positioned to tell us of the impact or maybe the implication impact of this amendment, more especially on the revenue and the, or maybe the fiscal or the fiscal framework, as to how is this going to help out the balance between revenue and expenditure, but also our borrowing patterns. And also the debt levels and debt interest. I'm not sure, Chair. I don't think we're in a position, and I'm not sure how long will this take, because we really need to confirm this before we move forward. I'm a bit worried if we will just do that without their opinion. We might be deprived of an opportunity to do that. So I'm not sure how long it will take them, I mean, to just give an indication of the impact of this amendment that's prescribed by the state.
Senator?
Chairman, thank you, and thank you to Frank. I'm looking at section 11.3. And Frank, you're saying that these things aren't cost concern, but if you look there at subsection 3, and it's Timothy's must. Now must is a must, a bigotry as far as I know. And so it raises the question in my mind then, is that Dave was raising is, you know, we need to go through these and meet those requirements. And the one specific requirement then that I want to ask you about, Frank, is to move on to subsection 4A. The rules must provide for the Committee on Finance to hold public hearings. Now, this one is interesting because it says the rules must. It doesn't say the Committee must. So the rules must provide for the committee to do it, but it doesn't say the committee must do it. Yeah, it's an interesting word in there. So, Frank, in your opinion, must we hold public hearings on this?
Right, Brandon?
Yeah, if I can add my two cents words there, I believe that no obligation, and to the extent there has been formal public consultation in any case. So to do what the I think on order A to E, we could probably answer them quite simply ourselves here. And then going back to our previous question, which is item number C, which we're discussing now, I think we could do a rough calculation. We know how many taxpayers we have in the country, so it's a small number. We know how many are in problems, so we can make a couple of assumptions, and that would support what the National Treasurer basically is saying. It is the minimum. Effectively, it's probably going to be under, it's probably going to be a rounding figure, and that will allow us to do this. And secondly, if you take into account the effect of that value on March 2016, that means it's not going to affect the current fiscal year, and any effects of this will be fully calculated into the following budget, which comes in. So it's probably possible to pass this.
Can I ask, Frank,
Is it fund for the treasury?
Yeah.
Okay. Alright, that is, I'm ruling on that. That's run next week's meeting, or Friday meeting. I just want to ask, can the treasury use the Money Bills Act to introduce an amendment of this nature? The second issue is, of course, treasury will say, well, if you all agree with us, then you take it as your amendment and do it, right? Now, that's fine, but this is an open meeting. And someone who doesn't like it can challenge and say, well, yes, the parliamentary committee did it, but it wasn't through its own exercise of its own oversight or so much as simply putting it to the committee, and the committee merely adopted and ensured they met the other provisions of the Money Bills Act. I think the point Jed is making is, look, using the Money Bills Act for the first time, and what you don't want to do is then challenge the court, right? And then, it's going to make it difficult for the committee next time around to easily agree to changes, right? Especially that might come from the administration. So, you know, can you respond to the issue?
Thank you, Chair. The issue of public consultations, I totally agree there's various levels of public consultation, but when it comes to the constitutional obligation, that falls clearly within Parliament's domain, and that's been decided by the court already. However, in the case of your tax administration and tax laws amendment bill, we know that we follow a different procedure. We have the draft bill, we have public submissions on both. The court has basically said it must be reasonable. In other words, as they say, there must be a meaningful opportunity for people to make input into the provisions of a bill. Now, if we then have amendments like we have now, the question that one must ask is, are these new policy issues that are coming forward that the public has not seen before? And that's what we wanted to engage the public on, that to give them that meaningful opportunity. That is the question for you. If it's not law, it flows from various consultations during public consultations, or flow from a decision to say, well, some of the people have agreed or not agreed or comment on it, then in my view there has been public consultations on that point. So it's weighing up whether this is a new issue that has come in or not. If it's a shift of date or a subtle change of something that results, and I understand from changes, it results from further public consultation. I mean, in fact, the bill that was introduced was basically saying, look, we introduce it now, we have further consultations taking place and certain options in there, and that has come forward now. It would be prudent for this committee to at least just put it somewhere to say, look, we have these further consultations. Perhaps the people made submissions prior in June or July when we had the meeting, to ask them again, is there anything new you want to say about this? Public consultation doesn't have to result in a public hearing. I'm now talking with the eye on the shortage of time we have. But one can invite the public to comment on these amendments. It's not always necessary to invite them to comment on amendments. It specifically is as a result of public consultation, but it happened in Parliament. Parliament must take responsibility for its constitutional obligation in that regard. But as I say, we're seeing this draft bill process that we have with the tax laws. It's a bit of a shared responsibility. And I think we will comply with the Constitutional Court's finding that it must be reasonable. In other words, we cannot fall on the further side is there's absolutely no public consultation. We just accepted what the executive brought to us. We passed it like that. We promised public consultation, we never did. And that happened in a case about 8 or 9 years ago. And for that, we lost the court case. But I don't think that's the case here. There's a middle road, so at least just invite further public consultations. That's a financial issue. I mean, are we going to advertise that in newspapers? Are we going to put it on our website? Did we have targeted requests for further submissions? In other words, email the people who are involved, say to them, governing bodies distributed amongst your members, please. Because an advert in the newspaper costs quite a lot of money. And of course, you can go to the other side and solve the whole process and have a public hearing on it again. Chair, on the issue that Mr. Rees has raised, well, he raised the public consultation issue as well, but just the issue of that we must, yes, it must be done, but clearly, specifically the first part, sorry, let me just get the correct reference, subsection 3A, committee must ensure that the total amount of revenue raised is consistent with the approved fiscal framework and the division of revenue bill. In my view, that applies equally to the revised fiscal framework, just by analogy. So whatever we approve in this committee in terms of revenue collection for the revised fiscal framework, which will give effect to the revised fiscal framework, there must be, it's not correspond. So we must be sure that that correspond, and from the date I would agree with the submissions made, it certainly doesn't affect the revised fiscal framework, but it might affect the after years, it might affect some of the other things, so we need some evidence based on that. Chair, I must apologize, I was now spread all over the place. You had a specific issue I needed to comment on. Can you just... bring the amendment, thank you. Chair, I don't want to go on the philosophical point of how beautiful or ugly it is to make legislation, and a lot has been written about it. But it happens in other committees. It happens throughout the legislative process in Parliament.
That deals with affecting money bills. Yeah. I know we've done it before with other bills, but I'm not talking about those. I'm talking about the Money Bills Act, the bills that pertain or fall within the purview of the Money Bills Act.
Okay.
No, on rare occasions, the executive has some committees that I've been responsible for and say, look, this is what we want, and we agree with them, and we make the change, they come to the last minute. But this is something different.
Yes, thank you, Chair. The way we did it before was in terms of section, 14, which is specific amendments proposed by the minister. And that is limited to technical corrections to the bill. That's done in the past. And there's really quite an easy process for that. In this case, the minister is bringing new amendments. I think the question remains the same, chairperson. Is there a policy shift? Is there something new in there? If there's something new, there are two ways we can do that. Either the minister can withdraw the bill, correct the bill with the new policy issues and reintroduce, like with any other bill. After the first reading, the minister can withdraw the bill. Up to the second reading, my apologies. So that's one way. The second way is in terms of the Money Bills Act, where the minister brings it in, and if those proposed amendments still create new policy, I would think then public participation becomes very important for Parliament side. Because Parliament must know what the public is saying. With all respect, that Parliament is the forum for public participation, is the forum for public discourse in South Africa. It's not necessarily the constitutional obligation of national credit or any other government department. So then we should do it. I don't see a problem with substantively that we must say to the minister, you cannot bring these amendments. I think that would be too formalistic an approach to the Money Bills Act. I think the purpose of the Money Bills Act, if I can take like this, and people have written about it, it actually ties Parliament's hands not to intrude into the domain of finance policy. Because the Constitution reserves that almost exclusively to the Minister of Finance, of course, in consultation with Cabinet. When we read those provisions and who may introduce a money bill and so forth. So there's nothing, I think, that will prevent the Minister or the Committee to receive those issues. But we must see them in a broader context than just the Money Bills Act. So this Act is basically saying to Parliament, if you want to amend the money bill, this is what you do. Treasury is actually still free to bring in those amendments and to say that. I think then Parliament is treated as almost as to say, well, this is a new part of the bill. We put it in there, but if there's a new part of the bill, we want to hear what the public has to say for themselves, because otherwise we can be knocked down for that.
All right, some more.
I don't want to take away from what Advocate Jenkins said, because we've exhausted that. That's fine. All I was going to say, and this is if it helps, because I think she's put the case very well. And we were sitting with a dilemma. This is clearly not a technical change from the table version. But just to also remind ourselves, so we have the law as it is. The minister makes an announcement in the budget, and the bill gets tabled in July. The tabled bill, for example, kept to option one. But remember, option one is no change, except for the special, okay, which is a minor part of that. Okay. When it came to changing the bill, we then had to say, do we just keep it as it is, or because we thought we were going the other direction until we heard the responses. So we put the maximum option 2. Okay. That was brought in. If in fact we do what we have, what we in fact proposing, it goes back to where we were in July with the threshold change, the minimum threshold change, and that's it. Okay. Because all these other provisions on this clause were to get to option 2, which we are actually not dealing with. So we are therefore consulting. What I'm asking is there less of a burden? I know it's a table goal that had option 2, but in a sense we're now arguing there should be no change from what's in the current law. In terms of some of the other issues, of course, the criteria, I mean, I think you generally could easily say that, you know, what's factored into the revenue assumptions and what's not, and this covers really from next year on, so it doesn't really change the current year in any way. So it was quite easy to give you a chair. If we form a note, if you want, on those, or Parliament that cover, it's your right, obviously. I'm just offering if you want us to do that, to do it pretty quickly. Before Friday, we'll do it this afternoon.
We have to abide by the law.
Yeah.
All right. Basically, who wants to respond? And look, it's now 21. We should tie up shortly. 1 o'clock to the deadline. Maybe you can carry on if you want. I don't have to be here.
Yeah, yes,
you've got another issue.
So, at that stage, I think to them, we've got to listen into all the submissions. I think they really need for that subcommittee. So,
yeah.
Listen into and
are you agreeing with it?
Yeah.
Well, I understand if you don't want to share it, I'll share it. But I prefer you talk.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, I'm conflicted here because we've gone a long way with this bill now, from where we started, and but at the same time, we can't afford to take a precedent here. If we start saying that we can now use the Money Bills Act, despite the fact that it's in conflict with Section 14 and not just the technical change, there may be other bills in the future where we are not all in agreement. But now we're going to take a precedent, and I would like to ask Momo and the team, how long would it take to simply withdraw and resubmit the bill, and could we not do it that way, and then everyone's happy and there's no danger?
Yeah, I'm not sure if Dennis can answer that. I think what Elka Kalis is asking is what's the easiest part? I guess. But I guess the etiquette needs to advise us and get to the Parliamentary Programming Committee.
I'm sorry, my apologies. You're right. Now, Frank, don't say anything about that.
Yeah, sure. It would be a programming issue, and the way I see this time of year, I think the program is stuck, and it will actually open up other doors which we don't really want to open up with further issues now. So, what I want to say again to Honourable Mr. Lees, the issue of the minister, I think those are the questions. The minister is proposing amendments, but in terms of Section 11. So we're not falling foul of Section 14. Section 14 has a specific purpose, and those are the technical amendments which were for last year and the year before. So the question is, can the minister come and propose amendments to the committee, like anybody else, whether you're a member of the committee or a member of the public, propose amendments to a money bill, specifically a revenue bill in terms of Section 11? My view is, there's nothing preventing the minister. There's not the purpose of the legislation, the minister can bring it. If it's a new thing, and as what I hear Mr. Monia has said, is that there were the options, and one found themselves in the draft bill and another one found itself in the bill that was tabled. One can look at it from the point of view, but these options were out there in the public. They have been discussed. We have evidence. It would be prudent for this committee just to send that email to the stakeholders to ask them, do you have anything further to say other than what we've received that you have given to the National Treasury on this issue, and then move forward. It's not necessary to bring a new bill. I don't think there's time, and I don't think we would set a bad precedent by following this route by saying, let's consider the amendments and see whether they should be included. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. And from a practical perspective, Chair, and this is trying to be helpful, if we keep the provisions more or less like they are, then they're not going to come into operation within the next year in any event. What we'll have to do is then next year change them. So that's an issue of basically I'm not wasting time by doing it, and I'm not creating more uncertainty in that way. But that's a different story. I mean, that's not an option I want to actually even put to the committee. I think, just in short, I don't see anything prohibiting or preventing the minister from proposing amendments in terms of Section 11. It will be the committee who make those, and the committee will report its amendments, not the minister's amendments, will report its amendments to the House. So therefore, we must be satisfied if we are compliant. Thank you, Chair.
All right, can I suggest a way forward, right? And you see whether you agree or not. I don't know what you do, but it seems to me this idea of subcommittee now, I think that's a root go. The subcommittee should meet this afternoon. We can negotiate outside of the period when we're debating the fiscal framework in the House. It's the first period from 3 o'clock on of the sessions to ministers anyway. The committee can meet. In fact, it can meet the committee chair, the secretaries are here, and so on. I would like to suggest that how many people constitute the subcommittee? Well, it's a CAANC committee, so how many people do you want on the committee there? Probably themselves.
Yeah, actually, I'm not sure it's three of us, but it's a non-decision-making committee, and
But we want you to come with to the committee by Friday with the proposal.
I said that, Chairman, but can we, I mean, it's actually any member of Parliament could come.
Yeah, okay, let's set it open, right? Between Jason and me, we'll just have to chair it. So let's have it an open subcommittee. I will now go and speak to the House Chair. We've got a committee meeting of chairpersons now. And speak to the House Chair. And now speak to the chief of on our side and on the sorts of stuff. You can be exempted from the House tomorrow afternoon as well. Tomorrow morning is caucus today, I will obviously also serve on the committee. But should I chair it, not that we're here than me. I would prefer him to chair it, but let's see what he has to say. Well, have you said now? Are you happy to chair it? I'll come to the meeting. But I will.
To be provided as a letter of agency, but also I would appreciate if the advocate can collapse his advice to something better, so as we are able then to integrate them.
You covered it rather nicely. It's good. The first is that the committee secretaries are available to the subcommittee, so you're coming before.
Yeah, I'm trying to focus the
Especially the two secretaries now will get venue and so on. I would suggest to give people a bit of a breather, half of two as the subcommittee meets, right? Is that okay? A venue near the National Assembly, because there will be a G20 if possible. Then whoever wants to be in the meeting is free to be there, but you must have obviously National Assembly too. Frank Jenkins is a lawyer, PBO. You have to be there to meet him. So, is anybody else there you think should be in the subcommittee? So basically, you're going to look at the legal issues, right? You're also going to go through clause by clause, but if you don't want to do the clause by clause, we can do it on Friday, you know. But you're nice to just get that done. Because as I understand it, because that's the next step we're going to take, the reason time is to look at our last meeting. And look, from what I can tell, most of the, if not all of the key policy issues, there was some agreement on them, right? So it's no matter of going back to them. So how you are going to help us with that. Can you just look at your notes? And tell us whether there are any other policy issues, apart from the climate reform. This can you remember? Because we met about 2 weeks ago, and we met on the G26, right? And we went through the issues. And from what I remember, on our side, most of the issues were policy issues, were addressed, right? But you can't even leave that side and say, look, these outstanding issues. From your side, Momo, do you remember where we left? We were so many meetings. The last time we had to look at the bill. Were there any policy issues outstanding, apart from the kind of reform? Do you remember? We look at the notes, I don't look at mine.
No, but except the new issue that I alluded to earlier on the insurance.
Yeah,
that
obviously.
Now covered.
Yeah.
But I don't, the Banking Association, we said we'd talk to them, but I think we've sorted those out. There's no new issues.
Yeah.
but I don't recall.
Yeah. And then on R&D, look, Jez has been very busy and so on, and maybe I should find some time as well. You set up a subcommittee, but I think there is agreement, because I spoke over the phone, I think we misunderstood each other, and he agreed. You see, what we're trying to do from the college is, where there are issues where people are burning preoccupation, it seems reasonable to us, though we don't know whether they entirely agree with them or not. We can sit here in the whole committee and discuss it. So we invite them in, invite Treasury in, take into the Sun and his team, listen to both sides, and then the first time the report back. I met for 2 hours yesterday, and this is what we agreed on. So the R&D guy, I don't know if anything happens since now, speak to Jez. That's a, in our report to Parliament, we need to say something about R&D. When you say something, if we use the Money Bills Act, we'll do a proper report. You know, a decision being said, and other issues. So we're not just going to say we vote on the bill with the following amendment. We're going to have a report rate. The family will do the first draft, and we will work on it with the technically. Or you do it the other way around, but the family will put you together. So those are the issues. Is there anything else, members, in the draft? No. Thanks everybody, and thank also people who came from the industry and wherever else they came from. Thank you indeed. Sorry? What do you want?